Assalamu alaikum, and thank you, dear colleagues, for inviting me to your conference on Muslim women in Europe. I'm sorry I couldn't be with you in person, but when you are hearing this, I expect to be at my son's wedding in Turkey, inshallah. In truth, I don't know much about European Muslim women's lives other than what friends have shared and what I've read in the news. Since the longest I've lived at a stretch in Europe was for 3 months in 2008, when I was teaching at the University of Amsterdam. And although that was a rather demoralizing experience for me in many ways, as were visits to other European cities, I did get to see that Muslims, and especially women who wear a hijab, are a hyper-visible and denigrated minority in many European countries. This is in contrast to the US, where Muslims are just one minority amongst others, and we don't dominate the political landscape or public consciousness in the same way. Of course, this changed a bit after the 9/11/2001 attacks by a group of mostly Saudi men. But in general, European antipathy to Islam has much older roots than it does here. In fact, it dates from medieval Europeans' first encounters with Islam over 1,000 years ago. And while it targets all Muslims, it has a disproportionate impact on women who, unfortunately, also encounter discrimination in their own communities due to the popular Muslim belief that the Quran ordains our subjugation to men. I will be exploring the implications of this double bind for European Muslim women, which results from living in a liminal space in between their own communities and the secular societies in which these are located. This isn't to say that you're merely victims of both. Rather, my point is that the historical and ideological situatedness of your lives makes you vulnerable both to Islamophobia and to the sexism of Muslim cultures. As examples of Islamophobia, I take European representations of the Prophet and of Muslim women. And as evidence of Muslim sexism, dominant interpretations of the Quran as a male privileging text that allegedly discriminates against women. I also contrast this with my own reading of the Quran as both liberatory and anti-patriarchal. In using the word Muslim, I don't assume that everyone who is born one is observant. And nor do I assume that observant Muslims know the Quran. In fact, about 80% don't read it, according to surveys. However, non-observant Muslims aren't exempt from the repercussions of Islamophobia, just as observant Muslims who don't know the Quran aren't exempt from the impact of how the minority reads it. But before I speculate on the situatedness of your own lives, I thought I'd say a few words about my own. I was born and brought up in Pakistan, the world's second largest Muslim country, as you must know. Starting at about age 11, I was taught to read the Quran. But since none of the Maulvis who taught me knew Arabic, I only found out what I was reading through an English translation in my teens. At the time, I didn't know that this was a notoriously bad one, and nor that the Islam with which I was growing up departed significantly from Quranic teachings and, in fact, violated its conceptions of God, while also propagating very questionable claims about its position on men's authority over women. And nor indeed did I know that Europe had a more than millennium-long history of demonizing Islam, since I received a Eurocentric education, first in Catholic convents and later in a Presbyterian college. I guess this was the legacy of British colonial rule in my part of the world. My books either didn't mention Muslims or portrayed them as degenerates who had no history, let alone a civilization to speak of. By now, though, and I'm 72, I've spent more than half my life in the US. I've also come to read the Quran very differently from how I first did. And I've discovered that Muslims were in the West before it became the West, and indeed allowed it to become the West, since Muslim learning, innovations, and achievements also underpinned Europe's Renaissance and Enlightenment. On the other hand, Europe's history with Muslims, and I'm not saying the history is only limited to this, but it includes colonization and gross misrepresentations of Islam, the Prophet, and the Quran over the course of centuries. So, for instance, one of the earliest depictions of the Prophet by medieval Christians, including the ones who were living in Muslim-ruled Spain, was as the Antichrist, since they looked to the Bible and Christian history to explain Islam. And as the historian Robert Southern says, this is how they were able to read into it, and I quote from him, "the signs of a sinister conspiracy against Christianity and even that total negation of it, which should mark the contrivances of Antichrist." Although European views of Islam began to shift after the First Crusade, they still continued to paint pictures of it that were only accidentally true. And to quote Southern once again, "legends and fantasies were taken to represent a more or less truthful account of what they purported to describe. But as soon as they were produced, they took on a literary life of their own, changing very little from generation to generation," end quote. I think this is clear from contemporary European cartoons of the Prophet as a terrorist, a figure that seems to be a secular version of the Antichrist. So even though the content of the two representations differs, their ideological function remains the same, and this is to depict the Prophet and by extension Islam as the antithesis, the very opposite of Europe and the West. And I believe one can say the same of European images of Muslim women, that these have served as a foil for European women and also for the purposes of casting aspersions on Islam's alleged sexual laxity and violence. In the 18th and 19th century, Muslim women were mostly shown as semi-naked concubines languishing in some sultan's harem. And their images as sexual slaves contrasted sharply with those of Victorian women who were presented as, I quote, "pure, chaste, refined, and modest, and as safely secluded in the privacy of their own homes." Anyone who's interested in the quotations, which I may not always be able to cite online, you can always send me an email later on and I'd be happy to share them with you. Anyway, over the last century, as bodily exposure came to be seen as a sign of emancipation in the West, in other words, the idea that the more women uncover themselves, the more symbols of freedom they are, Muslim women also increasingly came to be depicted as being covered. Moreover, their head covering was treated as a symbol of their oppression, in contrast to, say, the habits, you know, that Catholic nuns wear, which are taken to signal their religiosity and chastity. The reality, of course, is that Muslim women wear the hijab or niqab or burqa for different reasons. For some, it is a freely chosen marker of their religious or cultural identities and of their difference in secular societies. For others, of course, it is a socially enforced mode of religiosity, primarily by male relatives. But in any event, representing all Muslim women who are covered as oppressed not only ignores the complexity of their choices, but also seems to be the flip side of their representation as harem slaves. However, what is common to both depictions is the missing image of the Muslim man as an overly sexualized predator slash oppressor, whose violence and misogyny are then ascribed to Islam and the Quran. As an example, is this short film made in 2004 by the Somali Dutch activist Ayaan Hirsi Ali and the filmmaker Theo van Gogh. This was in Holland. And this shows scantily clad Muslim women with bruises and phrases from the Quran on their bodies. According to Ali, she and Van Gogh wanted to prove that the Quran itself incites sexual violence against women. And she said this was meant to promote debates about the Quran in the Dutch Muslim community. Now, any reasonable person would know that desecrating the sacred texts and symbols of a religion is not the best way to initiate a dialogue. Even the title of the film was a provocation, since Islam is also called submission to God, of course. Given Hirsi Ali's anti-Islamic record, it's hard not to wonder if she wanted to provoke violence as a way to validate her criticisms of Islam and Muslims as barbaric, backward, and violent. And this is exactly what happened when a Moroccan immigrant ended up killing Van Gogh. And as is customary for the Western media, instead of condemning the man, it rushed to call the murder, I quote, a ritual slaughter and a homegrown jihad, I'm quoting, which showed that traditional values have been eroded in a country roiled by Muslim extremism, end quote. The title of the article from which I've quoted blared, "The Netherlands, not so Dutch anymore." And the segment of 60 Minutes, which is a CBS TV show in the US that I've also referenced, was called Slaughter and Submission. However, the fact that I have problems with the film and media coverage of Van Gogh's murder doesn't mean that Muslims don't justify violence against women based on their reading of specific verses in the Quran, notably 434. I will speak about that shortly, but meanwhile, I want to note that the practice of veiling, and I'm using the word very loosely, exemplifies the double bind of European Muslim women's lives, since both those who wear the hijab as well as those who don't are subject to harassment and even legal penalties, depending on where they're living. Thus, women who wear a hijab or niqab in Europe are seen as flaunting its secular values and face punitive measures such as being excluded from certain jobs. On the other hand, those who don't wear a hijab or burqa in some Muslim communities and countries are seen as flaunting Islamic values, and they face criticism and sometimes even violence. I have read about Muslim men just walking up to a woman who is not wearing a hijab and slapping her. And if the European desire to rip the veil off Muslim women reveals their own erotic investment in seeing, the phrase is Meyda Yeginoglu's, Muslim views of clad or fully clad women or veiled women as, quote, repositories of morality actually mask a fear of seeing women's bodies, which are thought to be pudendal, polluting, and promiscuous. Pudenda, by the way, means genitals or genitalia. Now, you can find this view in Quranic tafsir, in the Hadith, and in Muslim sexual ethics. And of course, I don't have a time to do an extensive summary, but just to give you a sense of it, for about 6 centuries after the Quran was revealed, scholars had ruled that both men and women could show those parts of their bodies that weren't pudendal, which is to say genitalia. But starting in the 13th century, some exegetes began to claim that a woman's face and hands were also pudenda, and that even the gaze, the way we look, was a messenger of fornication. Meanwhile, some hadith call women unclean and evil temptresses, the greatest fitna, that is to say, a source of conflict for men. While Muslim sexual ethics conveys, and I quote from Anne-Marie Schimmel's work, a fear of the uncontrollable, dangerous, and yet fascinating power of sex, and the tendency to see all the dreaded, hence hated aspects of life in woman who is associated with sex. So given all of these views, veiling or covering is actually meant to protect men's sexual virtue by hiding female bodies from their gaze. But I propose to you that this view is completely antithetical to the Quran's teachings about dress, on which there are two main sets of verses. One of these mentions a jilbab, and it is very specific to certain social and historical conditions of the time that no longer exist. I'm going to quote this to you. The translation is by Abdullah Yusuf Ali. O Prophet, tell thy wives and daughters and the believing women that they should cast their jilbab over their persons when abroad. That is most convenient, that they should be known, and within brackets, Yusuf Ali writes, as free women, not slaves, and not molested by the hypocrites and those in whose hearts is a disease, and those who stir up sedition in the city being Medina. Now, I know you don't have this verse in front of you, but from my reading it, I hope it's clear that the verses are asking the Prophet, not husbands or fathers or brothers or sons, to advise women about the jilbab. And these verses make no claims about women's bodies, and nor do they say the jilbab is meant to protect Muslim women and men from one another, nor, in fact, do they describe it as having to do with women's virtue. Its only stated function is to identify Muslim women to jahili, which is to say non-Muslim men, so as to deter these men from molesting the women. And since women's slaves weren't allowed to cover themselves in public, veiling oneself was an indicator of being a free woman. So to put this in some historical context, the law of the veil, not just in Arabia, but also in Europe at the time, signified which women were under male protection and which were, quote, fair game. It was therefore the fear of retribution at the hands of women's male relatives that kept sexual predators from assaulting or harassing them. If this hadn't been the custom, the jilbab also wouldn't have meant anything. And since this is no longer the custom, it doesn't have the same function that it once did. It's true that many Muslims regard their own, as well as Western societies, as jahili or ignorant. And on this basis, they claim that women must continue wearing it. But most countries now have laws against sexual predation, and the onus is no longer on women to protect ourselves by wearing certain clothing. More to the point, the second set of verses in the Quran that also deal with dress tell both men and women that they are responsible for their own purity, and they caution both to behave modestly vis-a-vis one another. This is Surah 24, verses 30 and 31, also in Abdullah Yusuf Ali. Say to the believing men that they should lower their gaze and guard their modesty. This will make for greater purity for them. And there are a few more lines. And say to the believing women that they should lower their gaze and guard their modesty, that they should not display the beauty and ornaments except what must ordinarily appear thereof, that they should draw their khamur over their bosoms and not display their beauty except to. And at this point in the verse, there's a list of male relatives in front of whom women don't have to observe these restrictions. Now, as may also be apparent to you, these verses aren't specifically addressed to people in a 7th century tribal Arab patriarchy, because they're in the nature of general principles about deportment, about conduct, about behavior. So this is why I take them as being normative, since they aren't history or culture bound. As for the ambiguities in these verses about what can ordinarily appear, as I noted, while some scholars even ruled that a woman's face should be covered, the Quran's instruction to men to lower their gaze only makes sense if men are able to see women's faces. And of course, the other way around. Otherwise, why lower your gaze if everybody's face is covered? Lastly, these verses also don't say anything about women's body or sexuality, but unlike the jilbab verses, they apply the notion of purity and modesty to men as well. The truth, of course, is that Muslims rarely consider the significance of this injunction for men, which perhaps isn't surprising, since Muslim cultures are embedded in ideologies of male supremacy, which even depict husbands as their wives, I quote, earthly gods. Indeed, most Muslims seem to think of Islam itself as male worshipping, and the phrase is Abdul Wahhab Purdibas. And this creates another double bind in Muslim women's lives who are caught between serving God and serving men. In fact, in some societies, and this is, of course, my personal opinion, women can't even fully serve God because the Islam that these societies practice has little to do with the Quran's teachings. This is true not only of Pakistan, but of all Muslim countries, and especially Saudi-ruled Arabia, Taliban-ruled Afghanistan, and clerically-ruled Iran, each of which has innovated their own version of Islam. Beheading people for adultery, which is not mentioned in the Quran, nor does the Quran mention stoning to death for adultery. So these are their own versions. There are many political and historical reasons for this gap or disjuncture between Quranic principles and Muslim practices. But I believe that classical knowledge has Islamized male worshipping cultures by masculinizing God and depicting the Quran as male privileging. For instance, Islamic theology takes the Quran's linguistic references to God as he and him as a license to render God male, even though the Quran insists that God is unlike all creation, and even though it forbids us to use similitude or comparison for God. For instance, Surah 112. Say, God is God, the one and only God, the eternal, absolute. God begetteth not, nor is God begotten, and there is none like unto God. Despite other verses to the same effect, however, Muslims map gender onto God, thus refuting the Quran's own descriptions of God. And they also misrepresent, according to me, six or so verses as mandating a gender hierarchy between men and women. For instance, classical tafsir of 434, as well as some other verses, claims that God prefers men, gives them a degree or daraja of superiority over women, makes them women's guardians, allows them to marry multiple wives and to hit a disobedient one, gives them double a woman's share in inheritance, and elevates the testimony over women's. But by now, of course, there are several studies that show the problems with these bald claims, many on linguistic grounds alone. For instance, Qawagun in 434, which is taken to mean guardians and even rulers, also denotes financial upkeep. And this is, in fact, how some classical exegetes themselves read it. I think it was Al-Tabari. I will also note that being a Qawamun is a husband's role, not his right, since it is contingent on his being able to provide for his wife, which not all husbands can do. Additionally, the word prefer in 434, which Muslims say God prefers men, It's not about divine partiality towards men. As Al-Hibri, Aziz Al-Hibri has pointed out, it is a reference to the resources of which God prefers to give more of to some men than to other men. And lest we forget, God also gives more to some women than to some men, as is obvious from the example of the Prophet's wife Khadija in relation to him. As to a wife's nushuz, Muslims interpret this to mean disobedience to the husband, although some scholars also claim that it could be disobedience to God. The point, however, is that the Quran also says that a wife can seek a divorce if she fears her husband's nushuz. So we either have to agree that husbands are also bound to obey their wives, or we look for another meaning of nushuz. Lastly, the word Muslims translate or interpret as strike, the root of the word being drb, idrubuna, which allows them to read 434 as the wife-beating verse, also means to leave, separate, cite, which is to say refer, and so on. But if we insist on reading it as wife-beating, basically we contradict all other Quranic teachings on marital relationships, all of them. These include the Quran's advice to spouses to dwell together in sukoon, which is often translated as love and mercy. But Mustansir Mir says that the meaning of sukoon is a state of mental satisfaction resulting from sexual fulfillment. That, in any event, is his interpretation. The Quran also instructs men to treat their wives kindly, including those they are divorcing, and even those wives who may be their enemies. One can offer similar counter-interpretations of other verses as well. For instance, the Quran doesn't allow all men to marry multiple wives, and it even forbade the Prophet to marry more wives at one point, even if their beauty pleases you, the Quran says. Then too, in the Quran, polygyny, that is to say multiple wives, is meant to ensure justice for orphans. In other words, the Quran only allows some wards of orphans to marry more than one under certain conditions, and it says monogamy is better because God has not made for man two hearts. Likewise, the daraja or degree men have over women is not an ontological claim. It refers to a husband's small advantage in a divorce, though scholars disagree as to whether the advantage lies in his being able to pronounce a divorce or in initiating a reconciliation with his wife. Also, parents inherit equal shares from a child's estate, and a wife's testimony counts for more than her husband's if he accuses her of adultery on his own witness. That is to say, if he can't produce four men. In such an instance, the Quran says she can refute his charge on her own witness. And if she does, her word is legally the last. But of course, we never ever hear about this mode of evidence giving. Nor do I think do Muslims adequately appreciate the fact that even within the confines of a 7th century tribal patriarchy, the Quran addressed women and their concerns, admitted their evidence in legal cases, broke the silence on their abuse, gave them inheritance rights, forbade men to inherit women, gave women a say in marriage contracts, and banned an existing form of divorce on the pleas of a wife. It also tasked husbands with caring for their families and being just to their wives, divorced wives, and orphans in their care. And it included fathers in its injunctions about child rearing, warning that God will call to account all those who kill their girls. So much for honor killings. Most importantly, the Quran taught that men and women are ontologically equal since they originate in the same self. So this is a bit of a background. Obviously, it's not exhaustive. It's just meant to give you some sense of the kinds of tendencies, male privileging tendencies there are. And my own work on the Quran was written in response to these tendencies. For instance, my approach to the hierarchy verses, as Aisha Hidayatullah calls them, that is the verses that are read as authorizing the gender hierarchy, I read them historically. That is to say, as dealing with gender relations in the tribal Arab patriarchy, that was the Quran's first audience. I also read these verses through the lenses of the Quran's foundational teachings. To be clear, these aren't just arbitrary choices on my part. The Quran itself refers to the contextual, that is to say, historical nature of some of its contents. It asks that we foreground or privilege its foundational ayat of clear meaning. It tells us to read the whole of it, which it says is from God, instead of dividing it into arbitrary parts. And it enjoins us to adhere to the best in it. So accordingly, I read the Quran's injunctions about men's and women's social roles and rights in light of its ontological claims about the creation of men and women from a single nafs, as well as of the fact that God made both Khalifa on earth, vice regents, named them one another's awliya, mutual guides, guardians, promises to judge them by the same standards, and to reward and punish them for the same reasons. So now I'm going to read to you 33:35, Surah 33, verse 35, Abdullah Yusuf Ali. For Muslim men and women, for believing men and women, for devout men and women, for men and women who are patient and constant, for men and women who humble themselves, for men and women who give in charity, for men and women who fast and deny themselves, for men and women who guard their chastity, and for men and women who engage much in God's praise, for them has God prepared forgiveness and great reward. By the way, when I mentioned this verse by its number, 33:35 in talks, practically no one in the Muslim audience knows it, but they all know verse 434. Anyway, according to tradition, this verse was revealed after the Prophet's wife, Umm Salama, asked why God was speaking only to men. Now, although I emphasize such verses over the hierarchy ones, my overall approach to the Quran is to interpret it in light of its statements about God. This is because I believe that as God's speech, we shouldn't interpret the Quran in ways that contradict what it says about God. To put it in more formal terms, I take God's self-disclosure, in other words, how God describes God in the Quran, as the theological and hermeneutical framework for my reading. And I focus in particular on three divine attributes. Out of God's many, many attributes, I, in my work, have focused only on three. God's unity, God's incomparability, and God's justice. And I read each of these attributes as being incompatible with theories of male privilege. So let me explain this briefly. The precept of Tawheed not only affirms God's unity, but also the absolute nature of God's sovereignty, in which no other can participate or partake. To do so is to commit shirk. This being so, I argue that men who posture as women's earthly gods or rulers or guardians or as intermediaries between women and God are guilty of shirk, since each of these roles allows them to exercise sovereignty over women, which only God can. On another note, God's inimitability, that is to say the Quran's declaration that, quote, there is none like unto God, nullifies the idea that God is gendered and that God favors men and discriminates against women because of their gender. In fact, as the Quran tells us, Not only did God create both from the same self, but they also proceed from one another in this world. Lastly, the Quran says that God's justice lies in not doing zulm. And it defines zulm as transgressing against the rights of another. So if God promises not to transgress against the rights of another, then I think it's incoherent to read God's speech as condoning zulm against women. Insofar as patriarchies allow men to transgress against the rights that God has given women, I take them to be forms of zulm. And I argue that the Quran doesn't condone them. But you know, this part of my argument isn't just based on this inferential leap. It's also based on applying a very clear definition of patriarchy to the Quran, which prior readers and critics of the Quran who make all sorts of claims about it being patriarchal had not done. And in the absence of a clear definition, we can all keep making claims that it's patriarchal or it's not patriarchal. So I describe patriarchy as a kind of a spectrum, at one end of which is rule by the father slash husband over women and children. And in religious patriarchies, this rule is justified by drawing on images of God as male and father. And the other definition of patriarchy, which I see as being in the other end of the spectrum and which is more applicable to our own times, is as a secular politics that privileges men and discriminates against women based on their biology. So it's on the basis of this definition that I call the Quran anti-patriarchal. And again, I don't have that much time to go into all aspects of my argument, but here's how I will sum it up. One reason I consider it anti-patriarchal is that it is the speech of an unsexed and ungendered God who rejects being called father. There are many passages which say, you know, that God is not the father of Jesus, and that there are some Jews and Christians who call themselves God's progeny, but God is not their father, literally or symbolically. The Quran also criticizes those who prefer to follow the ways of their fathers in preference to God. And all of these criticisms means that there is actually no literal or symbolic relationship between God's authority over human beings and men's authority over women. This is the kind of authority that classical knowledge allows men to claim, that as God is ruler in heaven, men are ruler over each other and over women, but they are not. Even kings like King David, you know, is mentioned in the Quran that he only exercises his kingship not as sovereign in his own right, but as a subject of God's. Another reason I consider the Quran anti-patriarchal is that it doesn't have a view of sexual differentiation. What do I mean by this? Basically, the Quran recognizes that there are biological differences between men and women, but it doesn't assign biology itself any kind of gender symbolism. For example, it doesn't say that because you're biologically male, these are the gender attributes you have, and because you are biologically a female, these are the gender attributes you have. And as Amina Wadood also notes, there is no concept of gendered man or woman in the Quran. And despite popular Muslim belief, not a single verse says that God gave men and women rights based on their sex or gender, or that their biological identities make them unequal. So if there is no theory of gender in the Quran, no concept of gender in the Quran, then on what basis can we say that the Quran has normativized a gender hierarchy from 7th century Arabia? This is why it's important, I feel, to distinguish between the universal and the particular in the Quran's teaching, which we can do since the Quran recognizes its own location within history. It's only Muslims who refuse to, because they think to recognize that is to nullify the sanctity and the universalism of God's word. But the Quran's sanctity cannot be nullified by human beings because it's a function of its relationship to God, not to us. And furthermore, the Quran's universalism lies in the ability of every new generation of Muslims to be able to read it in ever better ways. So these are some of the teachings that I feel are conducive for sexual equality and which allow observant Muslim women to claim that equality from within the framework of the Quran's teachings. I'm not pretending that it is a feminist text. In fact, I reject the term feminist for my own methodology because it derives primarily from the Quran's teachings, though of course I'm influenced by feminism and feminists' interpretations of other texts. But the reason I put this out there is because it's very easy for Muslims to just dismiss any liberatory reading of the Quran as, oh, well, this is feminist and feminism isn't Islamic. What we need today is a new scholarship in the Quran, better ways of bringing its message of equality to Muslim societies. And I believe that Muslim women, wherever they are located, in Europe, in their own countries, in the US, can play a crucial role in these tasks, not only because we are most impacted by how the Quran is read, but also because, as Umm Salma's question to the Prophet shows, we have every right to be involved in the creation of religious knowledge. I often like to point out that she wasn't even literate and she was not a feminist, and yet she asked the Prophet, how come God is not speaking to us? So this is also part of Muslim tradition. And I hope that you will be amongst those who will follow the Quran's advice to adhere to discover the best in its own precepts. Thank you.